Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Russ Avison is a liar. I did not quit. I was actually had hip replacement surgery, and this is Jim Christina, your host of The Writer's Block, and I am back. And I'm glad to be back, and this is LA Talk Radio, and of course you are listening to The Writer's Block, and once again, my name is Jim Christina, your host. My co-host is not here tonight with us. Sadly, she is in Las Vegas at a graduation. And so, Bobby Jean, we wish you the very best time in the world. Vegas is a good place to have it. And, of course, that means you're out of the country. So what are you going to do? Okay. We have a couple announcements tonight. We have Black Dog Publishing is one of the hosts of the Writer's Block, as is Out West Boutique and Cultural Center and Target Freight Management. And, you know, we mention Target Freight every year, or every night, actually, every week. And we do it every show. And we mentioned that they have a full truckload service. That's the best in the industry. But have we mentioned that TFM Truckload is the finest in the industry and gets your freight there every time, on time, at the rates you need for your transportation costs? Call today, 844-653-7789, and tell them you heard it here on The Writer's Block, and they'll have a little something extra for you. And while we're at it, if you are an LTL shipper, which if those of you who don't know what that is, it's less than truckload, you are probably looking for the best rates at the least hassle. Call Target Freight Management. Their customized transportation management system is just a ticket to getting your freight moved your way. Call Target Freight Management today at 1-888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web. Call today. You won't be sorry you did. And no, you won't be, because I use them daily, and I love them. They're great people. As a matter of fact, the owner of Target Freight is going to be here next week. He's just not going to have time to come into the studio, so bummer. I have to mention something about the 22nd, which was a show with Casey Teffertiller. What a wonderful show. I finally got to listen to it sober. about a week ago, and what a great guy. Casey was wrote the definitive book on Wyatt Earp, and my friend Russ Avison, who is our occasional co-host here, and our friend Court Joyner came in and subbed for Bobby and myself and did a wonderful job of interviewing. And Casey was just absolutely the one most wonderful guest, and of course I had to call in, and I was stoned out of my skull, but that's okay. I was just out of surgery. It's authorized. If you want to call in and talk to tonight's guest, which I'm sure there's somebody around Tennessee that might want to do that. Candace, if you're listening, Candace Wade from the Horse Sluts, the number to call in here is 818-602-4929. That is 818-602-4929. That being said, our guest tonight is a repeat, is a gentleman who was on our show with us last March, at which time said Candace Wade came in and bogarted half his show, which was a lot of fun because those two got along. In fact, Bobby and I were thinking about going and getting a cup of coffee while you guys chatted. He is a playwright, author, Ken LaSalle, who grew up in Santa Ana, California, and has remained in the surrounding area his entire life. He was raised with strong blue-collar roots, which gave – no feet?
No feet.
Okay.
No.
Which gave him a progressive and environmentalist view. As a result, you'll find many of his stories touching those areas both geographically and philosophically. His passion is intense humor, meaningful drama, and finding answers to questions that define our lives. You can find out more about Ken on his very own website at www.kenlasalle.com. Ken, welcome back to The Writer's Block.
Very glad to be here.
And there we go. And you can thank me later for the clap. Okay, you were here in March, and we discussed at the time there was a book that you had finished called Climbing Maya.
That's right.
Yes. And briefly, it's about stuff that was going on in your life.
Yeah. Yeah, it was my first kind of foray into writing philosophy. And I really wanted to talk about success and what success is and what the meaning of it is rather than just how to find it, because there's so many publications, so many books out there that say, you know, this is how you get success, but what is it to even begin with?
Mm-hmm.
And with everything that had been going on in my life at the time, it seemed like the perfect time to talk about it. I had a friend who was dying of leukemia, a friend who was an alcoholic, and I was out of work. So it's usually in the depths of those things that you find the meaning that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. And I think we pretty much did that in Climbing Maya.
I really enjoyed the book. I mean, I just thought it was just tremendous. I thought it was a really, really, really good story, number one.
Thank you.
I, of course, you know, I'm Italian. I failed to see philosophy in anything. But the philosophical aspect of it, I got, but the story itself grabbed me more.
Sure. I mean, at the time, you know, you don't realize when you're going through these events that are going to shape your life.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're going on at the same time that you're thinking about something that mm-hmm. you think is really important, and somehow they fit together.
Right.
It's kind of amazing, and you just think, well, I've got to write about this.
Right. Now, you at one point in that book had mentioned that you had gone out to a job interview in the Inland Empire.
Oh, yeah.
And you led us through that
through that maze.
That maze of BS, I guess, would be the best way of putting it.
Yeah.
And it was like, left such a horrible taste in your mouth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I write full time now for a reason.
Well, sure. Tech writing doesn't pay that much.
No, tech writing pays fine. It's just the way that you get treated as a tech writer, because
sure.
when corporations have to make cuts, they look for who they think is the least necessary.
Right.
And somehow writers always seem to fit in that box.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you had, and at the time also, that you had introduced a character in your book who's actually sitting right next to you.
Yes, indeed.
And she actually had the patience in the wherewithal to put up with your being unemployed for as long as you were. And that would be your wife. Would you like to introduce your wife to our audience tonight?
America, this is Vicky.
Hello, everyone.
Come on, Vicky. Give it some gusto.
Hello.
Now let's swing around from Climbing Maya, because that was a great book, but you've got so many other projects, and you just before we went on the air, this is when he throws out to me, he goes, oh yeah, and I just finished a comedy album.
Released it back in April.
Yeah, okay. Talk.
Well, here's the thing. When I started writing, and maybe you can relate to this, I don't know, but when I first started writing full time, I thought, okay, I'll write a book, it'll take 4 or 5 months, sure. But what you don't realize is, okay, you've got 8 hours a day to fill.
Right.
And it turned out I can hammer out books pretty quick. So I thought, all right, well, then I will also do audiobooks, and I'll start producing my own audiobooks. And once I started playing around with that format, I thought, you know, there's a lot I can do with this. So mm-hmm. I ended up writing and producing and recording, and basically I'm a one-man show. I do everything myself. This audiobook called The Most Amazing Book You've Ever Heard in Your Entire Life, and You're Not Worth It. And basically the premise of the book is that it's all in audio, so you're not reading it. So
sure.
it's about a book that's supposed to be so great, pretty much nobody can write that.
It's the great American novel.
It's a tour.
Better than.
It's a tour behind the scenes of the great American
okay,
novel.
Okay, gotcha.
And the thing I was able to do with that is take the listener to the moon, to the inside of a live volcano, and all kinds of interesting places where I could talk about things of a more philosophical bent while it's also comedy. And after I did that, I thought, you know, I could do a lot more with this. So I started playing around with monologues, and I started playing around with different sounds. And then finally, I'm a huge Fire Sign Theater fan.
Oh, me too.
Oh, well,
oh, me
see,
too.
We have a lot more in common than we thought.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
And I have my whole life wanted to pair up with people that I could write and perform comedy with. But that's so hard to do, to find people committed to creating that kind of thing. So I thought, you know, I could probably, if I really worked hard at it enough, I could probably do something maybe not as good as Fireside Theater or Monty Python or Second City, but my own spin on it. Mm. So I released it under the auspices of the Third Wall, which is a comedy group that I created with Vicky, unbeknownst to her, because one day I dragged her into my home studio, sat her in front of a microphone, and I said, read this, and then read this. And after about an hour sitting inside the studio, Vicky said, can we take a break? So we took a break, and we came back and did about another half hour after that. And then I edited all of that together. And it's just so cool to be able to take music, sound effects, the script, and then edit it. And then you find out that in something like that, 90% of the work is in the editing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like it, with a book, for me, because I tend to pre-write a lot of stuff, I tend to wait until it's okay up in my head and then write it. But as it turns out, when you're doing a comedy album, it doesn't matter how good the writing is. What matters is if it plays in audio.
All right.
So the name of the album is The War on Green. And the premise is that we've got another war we have to fight, but who are we going to fight it against? Let's fight it against the color green.
Okay. I'm good. I'm there. I like it.
So it's myself and... Occasionally, you'll hear someone else's voice, and that's Vicky.
Ah.
Actually, occasionally, you'll hear someone else's voice, and that's me. Because my way of introducing other actors was to do a bunch of different voices.
Sure.
And then play with it in post-production, and
sure.
then twist it until it sounded so weird that I thought, that'll do.
You know, it amazes me that you even bring up the Fireside Theater, because they were like so totally 60s.
Yeah,
and
but,
early
you know,
70s.
They have a catalog that goes from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. And unfortunately, I mean, these guys are my heroes. These guys are just amazing. And I just, you know, worship the ground they walk on. And sadly, two of them have passed away. And there are two left. And one of my, like, dreams would be to get one of my albums into one of their hands.
Yeah.
Or two if they're clumsy.
Because when my first tour in Vietnam, we had when we were back in the rear, our mail guy had like every album they had made up to that point,
sure.
And plus big fat doobies, and he'd sit in his he'd sit in his hooch and he'd smoke dope and he'd listen to Fireside Theater, and you could hear the Fireside Theater coming out of his hooch, and then you could see the smoke coming out of his door. I mean, he could get the entire LZ stoned. You know, it's just him, Terry. I don't know where he is now. He's probably, you know, tacked to some wall someplace. But, yeah, that's when I first heard the Fireside Theater, and they were so funny. And I think they were so funny, and maybe you agree with me, is not because everything they did was hilarious, because it wasn't.
Right.
But they kept doing it. And they would keep up with the skit. Didn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny because I mentioned in I've got to plug something in a book that just came out in audio on Audible and iTunes today called False Starts. I mentioned a show called SCTV and
Second City TV.
Yes, and the thing I mentioned about them, the reason I thought they were so incredibly special is because they didn't care if you liked the joke or not.
Oh no,
they
no.
would go and go and go. They had a sketch called Vikings and Beekeepers.
Yes.
And, you know, that wasn't funny in the face of it, but then they just kept going. And the same thing with Fireside Theater. They would just take it, and the audience wasn't their business. You know, they were just there to have fun. And I honestly, after doing this album, and I have a lot of plans to do more once I settle down, I just found that it was just so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
It was just incredible fun.
Mm-hmm.
And Vicky was amazing because she would sit down with me as I played for her version 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. You know, every time just polishing it, tweaking it a little bit, saying, how's this sound? How's this sound? And she was great.
I still kept in the parts I didn't like.
I still kept in the parts she didn't like.
Well, yeah, you kind of have to because somebody's going to like them.
There's a sketch that she particularly hates called Auschwitz Beer.
Yes.
And she said, don't you think that's offensive? I said, I absolutely think that's offensive.
Oh, my God. You know, I was driving up to Fresno once, and I this is a funny story. Well, I don't know how it's funny. Vicky, you probably won't think this is funny.
Probably not.
But it had just been pouring rain for like 3 or 4 days, and this had to have been 100 years ago because we haven't had rain in Southern California in I don't know how long.
Yeah, that's and true.
And, you know, going up to Fresno, there's all these stockyards. And it was like everything was mud.
Oh, yeah.
And there's these cows standing around in these pens and all this mud. And the first thing that came to mind was cow schwitz.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and they're only there for one reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's enough of that.
Poor cows.
Oh, you mentioned false starts. What's the name of this comedy album again?
It's called The War on Green. It's by The Third Wall. The Third Wall also has a YouTube channel. And I would guess in the next 2 years I'm going to release another one. I would guess.
Okay, The War on Green. I have to get my pen out and put it back together again because I buy cheap shit. Okay, let's see. Jerry, you making notes? The bookie's home listening to this right now, actually.
Oh, gotcha.
Let me see. There we go. Okay, The War on Green. Okay, you mentioned false starts, and I would like to have, if you don't mind, I would like to read a little bit of this because this actually was very quite cute.
Go for it.
False starts. And this is a book that just came out.
Yes.
And Ken's take is this. I recently opened up my chest of childhood memories, faced a decade I had long since forgotten, and wrote these words. It was the hippest of times. It was the funkiest of times. It was the 1970s. And I grew up right there in the middle of it. I won talent shows. I went to camp. I fought the school bully for the honor of the girl I loved and lost my father. But having just turned 50, I decided the time had come to take an honest look at those years without the tinted lens of nostalgia, which allowed me to remember so much more. I never told the girl I defended that I loved her. I barely survived camp. No amount of talent show victories brought my father back, and to be honest, my memories weren't as accurate as I thought they were. The 70s were a swirling minefield filled with a family destroyed by poverty and divorce, horrible TV shows, bad disco on AM radio, wretched food, and the only saving grace of a child like me was Pong. How sad. My teachers tried to put me on drugs. My sister taught me the art of shoplifting. My best friend was Burp Boy. Life was a series of constant setbacks, a barrage of defeats, embarrassments, and false starts. And I wouldn't change a thing.
Not a thing.
What a great intro. What a great intro. Talk to me, Ken. Talk to me about this book. I want one of these.
I wish, you know, we just got it back. We just got the proof from the printer today, too.
Did you?
I wish I had a copy I could have brought. I don't know what to say. Yeah, Pong. It was terrible. It was a nightmare. It was awful.
It was the worst game in the world.
Loved it.
Well, it was Nintendo.
No, Pong wasn't Nintendo.
Wasn't it? Pong, it was just Pong.
Pong was made by Bushnell. I can't remember his first name, but he's the guy who founded Atari, and I might be wrong about that.
Atari. You're right. It was Atari, not
Nolan Bushnell. Bushnell.
Right.
That's right. But yeah, it was at the local Salvation Army Activity Center, and I never went because I never played sports, hated sports, couldn't see, so sports weren't my thing.
Yeah.
And then one day we heard about this machine called Pong. We had no idea what it was, and you know, I walked down there probably with a friend of mine at the time, but I remember the line going 5, 6, 7 people back, all to play Pong. And I scraped every quarter I could to play it.
Wow.
Because that's all we had. There were no other video games. There were some video games that were just horrible, but it was different in some way.
Yeah, it was. Well, Pong was like I told you before we went on the air, it's like, you know, being in my 20s at the time when Pong came out, it was just real easy to grab a couple of beers and get just totally mesmerized by that little bouncing white ball.
Sure.
And you'd miss it because you'd be going, wow.
and then some years later, a couple of years later, I wrote in the book about how I would go with my friends to the shopping mall, to South Coast Plaza, to go into Sears and play the first home Pong game. And there were crowds of kids who would be at the department store just so they could get a chance to play.
Oh, that's when you hooked it up and you turned to Channel 3. And
Yeah. It's amazing how Pied Piper-esque, you know, video games are, even when they're terrible.
Even today.
Especially today. Yeah.
And I mean, they're huge business.
For me. Yeah.
I mean, they have teams that go out and challenge each other and make tons of money.
Yeah, esports.
How did that happen?
I haven't a clue. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things I wanted to... I do a podcast called The Monday Morning Show, which usually is on Tuesday, Thursday, or Friday. But I wanted to do one episode just talking about esports because I do not understand it.
I don't either.
And I think that may be a sign of age. That really may be. There's kids 15, 16, 17 who, if they're listening right now, they're saying, well, clearly you don't know what you're talking about.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Wait a minute. Let's see. You must be, I don't know, 50.
Yeah.
And see, the sad part about it was they get 50. They go, that's 50 is nothing.
Yeah. Well.
I got a hot flash. For whoever's listening out there that is under 50, wait, your time is coming, and I'm going to laugh at you.
Just enjoy it while you can.
Enjoy it while you can, because when them ingrown toenails start and that gout hits, look out, buddy.
I honestly so don't want to know about that.
As I told you,
I just got my first crown a week ago.
Wow, really?
Yeah, and I'd never had one, and I was so proud of the fact that, you know, all of my friends, everybody I knew, including my wife, had had root canals or crowns or something, and I had been untouched, and I had been terrible with my dental, you know, taking care of my teeth as I grew up. Awful. But somehow I'd made it. And when I got my first crown, I thought, that is it.
That's it. Yeah, there's no going back.
There's no going. And then my dentist said to me, well, yeah, this is just age. Your teeth get brittle as you get older.
Yeah.
That's a terrible thing to say.
Yeah, when they hit your 60s and 70s, they start breaking.
Time to switch to tapioca.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, tapioca. Okay, music, sex, 70s, the Bee Gees.
That's funny because I just posted a whole thing.
I love the Bee Gees.
I just posted on Facebook the other day about how I was singing... How Can You Mend a Broken Heart to my dog, Shapoopy.
We have a strange
relationship.
Shapoopy?
Shapoopy. 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 That girl is hard to get. but we have a strange relationship where if I'm bored and I'm doing dishes or cooking or whatnot, I'll start singing and she'll start dancing with me on the floor. Oh, I mean, we're both on the... Well, anyway. But it sounded more like if you crossed the Bee Gees with Sammy Davis Jr., to be honest. But I mentioned that song in the book, which is why it was on my mind.
Uh-huh.
Because, that's one of the first songs I mentioned, because I talk about how I don't know if I first heard that song in the 70s.
Uh-huh.
But I will bet you they played it on AM radio.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
And we listened to so much AM radio, because all we had for, I don't know, until about, I think, 76 or 77 was AM radio.
Let me help you out. 93 KHJ, Boss Radio.
Ours was the Mighty 690.
Yes.
Coming over the border from Tijuana, Mexico.
Oh, yeah. You used to have, what's his name? Oh, God. Wolfman Jack used to broadcast from Tijuana.
Yeah.
Well, I'm from San Diego, boy. North County. So we used to get all that stuff. But we also used to get KHJ Boss Radio.
Yeah. And one of the other things I mentioned in the book is I wish I could remember the name of the station, but it was the CBS-affiliated radio station that at 9 p.m., I believe it was Tuesday nights, would play the Radio Mystery Theater.
Oh, that's the KNX.
KNX, New 70. 1070. Yes, 1070, yeah. And my brother and I, we would have a little pocket AM radio, and we would turn it on really low so my mom couldn't hear. And it was amazing.
I know.
And I really kind of feel bad that there's, you know, I mean, this sounds so cliched, but there's a generation or more of people who don't understand the power of the spoken word or of radio drama. It was really amazing.
It truly was.
Yeah, that was one of the first, one of my first inklings where I thought, I'd like to do something like that.
Yeah,
it was just so cool to listen to. And we would listen as much as we could until my mom came in and told us to turn it off. So usually we'd hear the first half of it, and then we'd lay in bed and talk about, how do you think it ended?
Oh, yeah. I used to listen to it on my radio next to my bed, and you know, I did that, until I was in my 30s.
Yeah.
Yeah, or 40s, actually.
Yeah, and as it turned out, one of the things that I was really grateful for finding out later in life was that my dad was a huge radio drama fan from the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. And my dad and I had so little in common that when we found out that we both loved radio drama, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It was great. And one year for his birthday, I gave him a big CD collection of radio dramas.
Oh, wow.
From back in the golden age of radio.
Yeah.
And then when he passed, he asked his wife, Blanche, my stepmom, to give me that CD collection.
Oh, very cool.
So it was great. Whenever I listen to it, I think about my dad, and it's really nice.
You know what I have at home? I have like probably, oh, geez. I would say close to 100 CDs of yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Wow.
You get them from Radio Classics.
Well, you know, oh my gosh, you're going to get me started because I have been looking at different websites where they have classic radio. Oh,
incidentally, it was a plug. Oh. Radio Classics, www.radioclassics.com. Go there and look if you like old-time radio.
Go there and look. One of the things that I have found occasionally on the internet, and it always attracts me almost to the point of doing it, is you can get the a recording of the radio on December 7th, 1942, from dawn to dusk.
And 41.
So 41. Excuse me. Did I say 42?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. I'm horrible with dates.
I know.
Anyway, that's a joke between us because once we were at a party and I was telling the story about our wedding day, and I said a year off.
Oh.
And I'm always a year off. Anyway, but they've got it where you can download it and listen to it from morning to night, so you hear the regular radio commercials, the regular radio shows, and then it turns into the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And I just think that would be really great to listen to. But who's got the time?
I know. I wish 24 hours of death and destruction.
Yeah. I wish that I had known about this stuff when I was, you know, 15 or 16. Yeah, back when summer vacation meant nothing but boredom.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, when I was that age, they didn't have the internet. I am older than the internet.
Yeah.
Yes, you are.
Oh, well, so is everyone here.
Yeah, everyone in this room is older than the internet by far. So Fall Starts, is this like an anthology of stories of your youth?
It's a little bit episodic.
Yeah.
And as my editor told me, he said, you know, I love your writing style because it's so rambling. And I thought, okay.
Rambling's good.
But it does kind of go from here to there and everywhere. Whatever I felt like commenting on at the time,
uh-huh.
Because it's not just about talking about the memories, but it's also about commenting on were things really as good back then as everyone is saying. Not always, no. Especially, you know, having AM radio to listen to, or at one point I talk about some of the products that we had back then. Some of them are still with us today, like Postum.
Oh, my God.
And Postum was a coffee substitute made from wheat.
Right.
And who would ever want to drink that? But it's still around.
It's still around, yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff from the 70s that are – well, Postum is actually from the 50s.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember – see, my mom would buy it. And that's why – that's the connection that I have.
Because, and Maypo.
Oh, my gosh.
I want my Maypo.
Yeah.
There's stuff like that. I mean, well, you know, I'm – child of the 50s, so
I don't know any of this. We've talked about this. It's a generation.
My wife is only 23 years old.
God bless you. Just wait, gout's coming your way.
23 plus.
But the Fall Starts, and it's a great name for a book.
You know, the funny thing is I thought of that name and I crossed it out and I thought, you've got to do better than that. And then one day I was talking to my friend Sean and I was saying, you know, maybe it's going to be this, maybe it's going to be this. At the beginning, I wanted to call it False Starts. He said, why don't you call it False Starts? That's a good name.
It is a good name.
Really?
It is a good name. Now, we met Sean in Climbing Maya.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. He and I are our best buds and we hang out quite a bit. And he's going to end up in something else that I write at some point. If I can just ever get him out of his house.
Yeah. You mentioned that was a problem.
Yeah, it's. I was just saying, I am such a great speaker. I was just mentioning this to Vicky tonight about how as you get older, it just seems like we never get out as much as we do as we were on the freeway driving here. So,
we don't go anywhere.
We don't go anywhere.
Well, I don't either.
Never so going.
I don't either. Hey, look, I'm going to take a real quick break and give our audience a chance to go potty and get some water. And we're going to play a little music by a country singer, actually a Western singer named Dave Stamey. And he wrote this song called Tonopah, and it is so good. So give a listen.
I carry my saddle by the side of the road. Hard rain's falling, wind blowing cold. East across the mountains, head of battle scene, telling me it's time to hurry home. If I had wings, go soaring back to Tonopah. Headlights glowing, the cars hurry past, just like the years, all flowing so fast.
And that is Dave Stamey and a song that he wrote, which I really, really, really like, called Tonopah. And we're back in the writer's block with writer, what's his name again? Ken LaSalle. I already knew that. I'd love to do that. Ken LaSalle and his lovely wife Vicky is here with him tonight too, which we're going to be asking her a little few questions. And if you're just now joining us, shame on you. This has been a fun half hour, and it's gone by very quickly. Actually, it's taken about a half an hour to go along.
Wow.
So. We've talked about false starts. You wrote a book, and a Grand Canyon.
Oh yeah.
And your subtitle on a Grand Canyon is One Man's Journey Through Depression.
Right.
Talk to me about that.
I never thought I would write memoirs. I never thought I would talk about myself in my writing. I wrote a lot of fiction as I was growing up, and that's where I thought I would end up going, writing novels. I still write novels. But I was in a writer's club. I can't remember the name of the woman in the writer's club, but there was a woman in the writer's club who wanted to start up a small publishing business. And she said, I'd love it if I had some writers who had some, books. And I thought, I don't want to give her something I really love, but I have this idea. And Vicky and I were going to get married. And at the time, I thought, I want to get this story out of my head about how I nearly killed myself at the Grand Canyon. And then ended up, with things working out really well. So it was about, 6 months before we got married. And I said, I think I'm going to sit down and write this. And I don't know what's going to happen to it, but maybe I'll give it to this lady and she'll start up this business. She never did. She never started up that business. But I ended up writing A Grand Canyon. And the strangest thing about it was that normally when you write a book, you kind of know ahead of time how you're going to end it.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea. I thought, I'll just write until I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
So we got, I started, not at my birth, but several years before I married my first wife. And I talked about everything that happened with our divorce. And basically, my divorce just destroyed me.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain point, I thought, I don't have to be depressed. I don't have to be in pain. I don't have to be miserable. I'll just kill myself. So I had a lot of very interesting ideas, interesting ways that I thought I could do it. But I thought, the Grand Canyon is a great place just to jump off of. It really isn't.
No.
Because when you get there, you find out that you'll fall about 100 yards, break your leg, starve, and get dehydrated.
Exactly. And wind up against a fence.
Yeah. So fortunately, that's not what happened. I didn't end up killing myself there. But I wrote that through when Vicky and I met, and when it got to a point where I thought, I better end this, we're going to be married soon, we decided to, I don't know if it was your idea or my idea, whose idea it was, but that we'd go to the Grand Canyon.
Uh-huh.
My dad and Blanche lived in Arizona at the time, and we were going to visit them, but we thought, let's shoot on over to the Grand Canyon, which was a very strange idea to me because I hadn't been there since I tried to kill myself.
Sure.
So that's how we ended. I thought this would be a great way to end the book. I go back to the Grand Canyon and everything works out. And it did, but it was weird, as so many things in my life are. So yeah, that's what became of the a Grand Canyon. And I never thought I would write about depression, but because that subtitle was never really meant to be there. And then at a certain point in the process of writing it, I thought, you were depressed.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought about that before. I just thought, this is just the normal way that people think.
Well, you know, to be quite frank, I think left brain people tend to voice their depression far more than right brain people do. And we tend to put it out far more than right brain people do. There came a time in my life, and I'm not going to go through the whole big story because it's irrelevant to what I'm going to say now. But there came a time in my life when I virtually had not a nickel. I was sitting in my swivel rocker. I had a bottle of black Jack Daniels, my black Abyssinian cat, Ira Hayes, and a .357 Magnum.
Okay. So you were in a good place.
I was in a really good place. And when I finished the blackjack, I thought to myself, well, I can't do this because if I do this, who's going to take care of the cat?
Sure.
Got to take care of your cat.
And, you know, it dawned on me that everybody who has saved themselves, pulled themselves back from that brink, there was usually an animal involved.
You know, the strange thing is in my case, when I went to the Grand Canyon, I thought I'd just drive down there, get it over with. Uh-huh. It was in the middle of monsoon season in Arizona. So I hit this enormous monsoon, crazy weather, lightning, hail, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And as I'm driving through this, I'm fighting with this storm to get my car to the Grand Canyon so I can kill myself.
Kill yourself.
So when I finally pulled up at the Grand Canyon, I thought, wait a minute, I've gone through all of this. Why can't I just deal with all the other minutiae
sure.
of my life?
Sure.
You didn't even make it to the Grand Canyon.
No, sure. Actually, I made it to the parking spot right next to the entrance.
Ah.
And you just couldn't see anything. The monsoon was so bad,
yeah,
you couldn't see anything.
Yeah, I've been there in Texas when it's rained so hard you can't see in front of your face.
Yeah.
So, but you wrote a book, and it's called A Grand Canyon. Mine was a song.
Oh.
And the name of the song was A Little Black Cat and a Bottle of Jack.
That's awesome. That's great.
And for some reason, it became pretty popular. A lot of people don't know this, and well, who read our bios know it. But I had a band for years and years and years in the Northwest, and we were very popular. And then, you know, we broke up, and I came down here. And so music is like on my back shelf now.
Oh, yeah.
But it used to be right in front of my face all the time. So when you are into creating, because I know that you do still write novels.
Yeah.
Not everything is real life, and not everything is real people. As you're creating characters and you're going through the process of putting a character together, how long does it take you normally to develop this character in the book to where he's finally a three-dimensional character in your book?
Well, if I had to pick one book in particular, let's say Heaven Enough,
mm-hmm.
Which came out just a couple of years ago. It's a book about... I like to say it's a book about love and loss on the Pacific Crest Trail. And, you know, for that character, even though I had kind of lived with that character for a while, mm-hmm. Vicki and I drove out to Warner Springs, where part of the book takes place. And I wanted her just to see the landscape and get a feel for what was out there as I told her the story of the book. So I knew what was going to happen. I knew where it was going.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really have, like, I didn't have my clutches into him until pretty far in. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the beginning of the book, the guy's wife dies. I've never dealt with that, but as you know, Sean's wife died.
Right.
And he and I for a long time had this conversation about which is worse, death or divorce. And I just thought, you know, I want to talk about death, even though I haven't experienced it, because I've experienced divorce, which is, in my mind, very similar.
It's worse.
And yeah, in many cases, worse. So he had to go through that and then go through the stages where he gets on the Pacific Crest Trail. And it wasn't until he meets another character named Heather that I started to, it was almost through the reflection from Heather that I started to see the character whose name's Matt Murphy. I started to see him through her reflection,
mm-hmm.
the way that, you know, the way that they tangoed. And then, actually, I've written two sequels, which are with my editor right now.
Mm.
And because once Heaven Enough came out and it started selling, people were asking me, so, you know, what happens next? What's going to happen next in the story? There was never supposed to be a sequel.
Right.
And I sat down with it and I thought, there's no way I can continue this story because it's very definitive. It's, mm-hmm. It ends, it really, really ends.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I'll make it the beginning. I'll make that the beginning of the story rather than the end of the story. So that's, instead of being a continuation, that is a launching point.
Okay.
And
that
so,
makes sense.
Yeah, and it's good because at the end of the book, he kind of makes a decision about what his, you know, life is going to be about, and that works as a launching point. And then I get into the, yeah, but for what? And that's when I really started to think, you know, what's the grand picture of this guy in his life?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not me, which is really fun, because when you start writing books, at least in my case, when I started writing books, a lot of my characters were very much like me.
Mm-hmm.
I would just talk through me, mm-hmm. you know? And then I started getting into this place where I wanted to deal with things that I didn't necessarily know about.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I can explain how you write about things you don't know about through a character who does,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know. Somehow it seems to work.
It does. Yeah. I've done it. Yeah.
Yeah,
it does work. But I think once you've developed a character so far, that even if you've only got two dimensions of this character out there, you know, and you're not quite working on your third yet, all of a sudden he starts knowing more than you do.
Yeah.
And isn't that odd the way that happens? And it does happen that way.
Yeah, and the character makes decisions that I would never in my life make. At a certain point in the third book, which is talking way in the future because, I mean, only the first book is out there right now, but at a certain point in the third book, he starts making these decisions to help the people in his life that I don't know if I would do. And it's nice to, you know, write someone who's better than me.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I learned something of your process when you were here in March. We didn't really get a chance to get too deeply into it because,
sure.
of course, we had Candace sitting here,
sure.
throwing out her wit and wisdom.
The lovely Candace Wade.
The lovely Candace Wade. So, Candace, if you're listening, we love you. But I know that you are a full-time writer now.
Yes.
And you've given up on the hunt for the perfect job.
No, absolutely. There is no perfect
job. And you found the perfect job.
Yeah.
Which is being home with, what's the name of your dog?
With Shapoopy and...
Shapoopy.
Should I say the full name?
Say the full name, please.
Princess Cha-Cha.
Princess Cha-Cha Shapoopy.
Yeah. Well, Shapoopy is a Shih-Poo. And when we got her, Vicky
said,
you name a part Shih Tzu, part Poodle?
Uh-huh.
And when we got her, Vicky said, what would you name a dog that was part Shih Tzu, part Poodle? A Shih Poo. I said, Shapoopy. Simple. I have a theatrical background.
He does.
That's my only excuse. And then when we got Cha-Cha, I said to Vicky, I said, okay, it's your turn. Go crazy. What are we going to name her? And we wanted to name her something that was at least touched on the Japanese culture. And Cha-Cha, there's a story there. What is it?
Cha-Cha is the name of a concubine / princess in their early ADs in Japan. And her name was Cha-Cha.
Cha-Cha.
She was a princess. Called yeah. Princess Cha-Cha.
And the thing I love about Cha-Cha is there's so many things you can do with it. I always say Cha-Cha Boom. And so so that's become kind of my way of calling her. And then we were at outside a pet store the other day, and some lady asked her name. I said, Cha-Cha. She started saying, Cha-Cha-Cha. I said, well.
That works too.
Yeah.
So how many hours a day do you write?
I don't have a set number of hours I write. My goal is just to move the bar, just keep the bar going. Like right now, I am working on formatting, taking a book and turning it into an audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nonfiction book, and the difficulty there is you've got to make it entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
So all the dry stuff that's in the book, I'm looking at ways of how am I going to make this interesting in an audio format. But in the process of that, I also get to re-edit it. So that's good because it's kind of an older book, and my writing style has changed a little bit, and I get to update facts and figures and things in it. So that's moving the bar a little bit. And then once I start recording that, that's going to move it. And at the time I'm working on that, I have ideas for titles that are going to come out in the future. The weird thing is I'm going to be on the Pacific Crest Trail in April. Who knows how far I'll make it? I might make it 12 miles. I don't know.
Well, at least make it 12 chapters, would you?
But the thing is that means I've got 5-6 months until then. So I'm kind of my schedule's kind of getting compressed as I get closer to that day, trying to fit everything in. Because I do a podcast. I do, as I said, I'm working on the audiobook.
Now you're a busy guy.
I do an awful lot. Check out kendlesall.com to find out more. Just want to play with my radio voice.
There you go.
But so as long as I'm working 8 to 10 hours a day on getting this mess of my career together, I'm usually satisfied. The weird thing is that when I first started writing full-time, I thought, I can play some video games. I could watch some TV. I don't have to write. But the thing is it kind of takes over your life. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is almost all I do now. And I love doing nothing but goofing off. I mean, that's one of my favorite things. But the idea that I'm living my life goofing off all the time,
but
doing
productively
what I
goofing
love.
Off.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this thing that so many people in my life have said, you know, you'll never be able to do that. And now I'm doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, why wouldn't I do it as many hours a day as I can? Vicky's going out of town next week, and she's asked me, so are you going to work all weekend long? I said, probably. Because, yeah, it's like that's where my fun is. That's where my to quote an overquoted Joseph Campbell quote, that's where my bliss is. So, yeah, I just anything to get keep the ball moving and keep things going. And that's why I come out with a new title it seems like at least every 3 or 4 months I've got a new title out.
Everybody says that about me, too. Why don't you write? God, you write so fast. No, actually, I don't. The last book I wrote, which was The Return, about the return of a demon that had chased in a book prior.
Wow.
Wound up in Louisiana. And, of course, doing the research about Louisiana and all this stuff, it took me a long time to write this book. It was probably close to a year. And this one done now, End of Line, has taken me a while, too. Now, Contraband Cowboys, which, incidentally, I just gave Ken a copy of Contraband Cowboys.
And I'm looking forward to reading it.
That one took, I would say, probably 6 to 7 months to write. The story was just sitting right in front of my head.
Sure.
You know, some of them are, some of them aren't. So, you know, some of them you got to reach for.
Yeah, in my case, I tend to pre-write a lot. I tend to just sit on an idea until I'm ready to just hammer out. And I will do, 3,000 words a day?
Something like that.
And I'll just hammer them out because it's already spelled out in my head. But then what I always forget about is then I've got to do rewrites. And then I've got to hand it to my editor.
Right.
And then I've got to do rewrites off of his editing.
Right.
And then I've got to hand it back and forth. And then, you know, if I'm working with a publisher, it goes back and forth. So usually a book will take 2-3 years from start to finish.
Sure.
You know, until it's out and I can actually hold it in my hand.
Sure.
But the writing itself, usually about 8 weeks is how long it takes to write a book. And then I'm off to the next book.
Sure.
Because I take about 3 months, sometimes less, to just let it go away and forget about it. So when I go back and look at it to edit it, I have more of a fresh eye. And the same thing happens when, you know, I'm doing audiobooks or whatever. I'll just shuffle things around. And that way I'm not constantly, you know, either constantly writing or constantly recording. You know, there's some variety in there.
Yeah. So what projects you got coming up?
Well, like I said, I'm working on False Starts is now out in audio and ebook. It's going to be out in paperback in probably about a week.
Okay.
Right now I'm working on a book called Dynamic Pluralism. The subtitle is A Revolution in Ethics. It's a book on ethics, which sounds a little strange with everything that I do, but after Climbing Maya, I thought, this is something I want to devote a lot of time to. I want to come out with a book on ethics, a book on philosophy, at least one every 2 years. And after that is out, and that'll be out the end of the year or in January, I think I want to work on another monologue, which is another thing I've been doing. Just however long I want to write it and record it, however, you know, sizable I want to make it, just one story about one thing that I've done. In June, I came out with The World's Worst Backpacker, and that was based on my life as a hiker and a backpacker, because I suck.
I actually read that on KenLaSalle.com.
Yeah, it turns out I'm really horrible about that, and I was on the PCT for 11 and a half miles, and I won't say I almost died of dehydration, but I almost got to the point where somebody had to call for a rescue chopper, and I thought, no, I'm going to make it back to civilization.
Or your wife will kill you.
Or my wife will kill me. So that's The World's Worst Backpacker,
gotcha.
Which is why I'm going back to the PCT, because I think The World's Worst Backpacker Hikes the PCT makes for a great title.
It does. It does. Hey, look, we got to run along. We're out of time, and it's so fast.
That just zips by.
It just zips by.
Very fast.
And want to let our listeners know where to find you, where they can get a hold of you, of course.
Sure.
One place.
I'm on KenLaSalle.com. On Twitter, I'm at KenLaSalle. Facebook, Ken LaSalle. I guess if you type Ken LaSalle, KenLaSalle, in Google, you'll find
You come up all over the place. All over the place. Thanks for bringing your lovely wife in.
Thank you.
Really great meeting you, finally. And this is an end to another great show. And Ken, thank you so much again for coming in and spending the entire time with us without having to share your time. And sorry, Candace, but you didn't get to make it. Next week we have Bobby June will be back in studio. October 13th we have Philip Donnelly, and he's written a couple books. One is called Seconds to Midnight, and the other is Pegasus Down. We're right in the middle of reading Pegasus Down right now. I understand it is a great read. It is so far. So let's look forward to Bobby Jean being back in studio on the 13th. The 20th, we have Caroline Giamanco, who wrote a book called The Boonie Hat Bandit, who is her husband / fiancé that was robbing banks in St. Louis, Missouri, wearing boonie hats. So he got caught, and he's in prison right now. So it's so she wrote a book called The Boonie Hat Bandit, The True Story of the Boonie Hat Bandit. And then on the 27th, we have Chelsea Hickman, who is a brand new playwright, is going to Riverside, UCR, right at the moment, and studying being a playwright, and she's an English major. So she ought to be really interesting to talk to. Brand new writers. I love to mess with their heads. Okay, again, thank you so much for joining us, Ken. Thank you for listening tonight, and we look forward to being with you next Thursday on The Writer's Block.